Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening, everybody, and thank you for joining us here on King Jordan Radio. Today is July 17th, 2013. Now, today, ladies and gentlemen, we have the honor and privilege of having a prosecutor that you see on CNN. You see her on HLN, Fox, CBS. She also has two books and a website. We'll get into that in a second. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Stacey Honowitz. Stacey, good evening. How are you?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you inviting me to be on the show tonight.
No question about it. And I told a little bit about you on the audience. Can you fill in the other parts about your books, the names, and your website?
Absolutely. Well, I've been a prosecutor for 25 years in Broward County, Florida, and I specialize in sex crimes and child abuse. I've been doing that for 20 years. And I have found in my travels and in my trials and in speaking with victims and with parents that many parents are having a difficult time talking to their kids about private parts and sexual abuse and what to say and feeling uncomfortable. So I decided to write two books to make it easy to break the ice for parents to talk to their kids. And the books are My Privates Are Private for Little Girls and Genius with a Penis Don't Touch for Little Boys. And I go around and I lecture to schools and to organizations and charities, anybody really that wants me to come to talk about the difficulties in prosecuting sex crimes and why it's so important to have these discussions with your kids starting at an early age. So really that's my primary goal right now, is to continue prosecuting these cases and to try to get these books into schools, because education is really the key to all of this. Knowledge is power, and if you bury your head in the sand and you don't talk to your kids, then there's going to be problems later on. So really that's my mission, to try to get sex crimes across the country to be talked about and to have education.
What was your main reason for getting involved with this, with sex crimes in itself? What struck you? Did anything ever happen to you, or did you see somebody, a friend, or what triggered you to get involved with this?
Well, when you start out in the office, of course, you're kind of thrown into cases, and you try out starting with misdemeanors when you first go into the office. I've been in the office, like I said, for 25 years, and then you gradually grow into a specialized area. I was very attracted to this area because I like dealing with kids. I think that I have the ability to kind of talk to kids. I've always had that ability, and I thought that my personality was such that I wouldn't be embarrassed to go into the courtroom and have to talk about these things. There's a lot of people that are very uncomfortable having to talk about sex crimes and private parts and, having sex with kids and having to discuss this with children. And I did not find that it was difficult. And maybe because I have a aggressive personality, people might say, and I don't get embarrassed easily. And so I found when I first started doing these that I've kind of had, a niche. I just found that the kids could relate to me, I could relate to them, and I could go into court and really be an advocate for them. Many years ago, I won a contest for Glamour magazine. It was your best asset. I was nominated. My best asset on your body was my lips, and the reason for that was because I have a big mouth and I'm able to talk in court on behalf of molested children and children that are the victims of abuse and neglect and rape. So I just found that I could really relate to it. I enjoy it. It's extremely rewarding. These types of cases are hard to do, and it's therapeutic for the parents to be able to come in and talk to somebody and have them listen. And I don't think that I present in a scary way that kids would be nervous to have to talk to me about stuff like this. So it's been extremely rewarding. And getting the books out there and trying to get them accepted is the next challenge that I've been working on.
Do you think that we're hearing more about it now because of maybe kids are more open now than maybe like 30, 40 years ago? Because, I'm 30,
oh, absolutely.
But I hear that.
Well, I'm not telling you
never
mine.
Heard
age, so I'm glad you revealed yours, but I'm not telling you mine. I'm considerably older. Let's put it that way. I'll leave it at that. But I knew anybody on the internet could find out how old I am. But, yes, I think you're 100% right. This is sex crimes, incest, all of these things have been going on for years. And the reason why we know that is because you have many people that come out later on in life that say, when I was a little kid, I never talked about it. It happened to me. I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. I didn't know who I could talk to. And we find that so many times when you have celebrities that write books, oftentimes they'll put in, they'll talk about their experience as a child, that they were molested, and that's why they are the way, you know, that's why their personality might be the way it is right now. So now it's much more open. It's talked about. It's discussed. It's on television. People know that if they don't get help, that it's a horrible secret that they have to live with. It's going to be a problem later on. And I just think people, you're right, are much more open to discussing it. And that's really the message I'm trying to get across, that it's so important to talk about it. It's so important not to be ashamed or embarrassed. When little kids come to my office and they don't want to talk about things in the beginning, I show them my file cabinet and I say, you're not alone. I have 1,000 other cases involving little boys and little girls. I've heard it all. It's nothing to be embarrassed about. And you're going to find that if you tell, that you're going to feel so much better because you're not punishing yourself. You're going to be punishing the perpetrator. So it's much more open. It's much more discussed. And I think it needs to be even further discussed. The conversation has to be ongoing. It just can't. You can't have one high-profile case on the air, examine it and analyze it to the nth degree for 3 weeks and then forget about it. I mean, these are really discussions that need to be ongoing all the time.
Yeah, I totally agree. Do you think that these people that commit these crimes on little children, can they be rehabilitated at all? Or that's just like a drug and they just can't stop it?
In my experience, I've seen so many repeat offenders, even people that I sent to prison 10 years ago who've gotten out and just repeated again. I've never seen rehabilitation with a pedophile, with a sex offender. I mean, there are different categories. There's the habitual compulsive sex offender. There's the opportunist sex offender who watches child porn on the internet and feels, you know, the need to go out and kind of experiment. But I've been on the air for many years with someone who is a known pedophile and who speaks very frankly about going to prison for his pedophilia and saying that it's something that he has to keep in check and control of every single day. He has to actually stop and analyze when he goes past a schoolyard or a bus stop, not to have that compulsion to try to talk to a kid or lure a kid. So that's been my experience. You know, I'm not a psychologist. My job is to punish, not to really get deep inside as to why they do that. That's left for the professional experts in the mental field.
Like I was listening to Howard Stern, and he said, you know, thank God I'm not into this stuff. When he was reading about Jerry Sandusky, he said, I would go into the hospital immediately and have myself evaluated if I ever thought like that. So.
Yeah, I mean, and there are many people that have those thoughts, and thankfully don't act out on them, but for the most part, those that do have the thoughts then do carry through with it. So, I mean, this is why I'm telling you, it's so important. You know, when people say to me, I don't want you to come to my school, I don't think the parents need to hear about this, it's too frightening, it's too scary, I always say to them, listen, would you rather have a 10-minute uncomfortable conversation with your kid or be 5 years in the state attorney's office waiting to go to trial and having to have your kid go through this? So, you know, it's really a mission and a goal of mine to awaken everybody to say, this is the real world. You know, you're not going to be able to shield. You have to give your kids the knowledge about what to do if, God forbid, anyone tries to touch them. Because, listen, my books are never going to prevent sex crimes. That's never going to happen. But it will prevent you from being a repeat victim. So if it happens to you one time, rather than letting it go and it keeps going on and you're a perpetual victim, after the first time you have to be able to say to your child, we're going to protect you. If you tell, you will be protected because that person will be punished. And really, that's the message that I'm trying to instill in society today.
That's a great thing. I commend you for that. And your website, of course, is www.stacyhonowitz.com,
right? Exactly, and it really does talk about the books, and certainly you can order the books from the website or from Amazon or, you know, if I come to the schools and lecture, I bring the books, or any charity organization, I lecture and I have the books with me. This is so, so important. I can't stress enough. And I can't begin to tell you how much resistance I get towards this. I mean, really, you would think being on the air so many evenings, having to talk about sex offenders and sexual predators and failing to register a sex offender and another child's been hurt, even with Ariel Castro, the guy that was keeping the three-year-old. I mean, you're going to have so much.
He kept notes.
So many,
he was sick,
mean, this,
you know, like
he
every
was
year.
Sick,
he would,
and this is so much of that really goes on. You know, and the funny thing, not funny, I should tell you that, the sad part is we only, you guys, not me, but the general
right.
public only sees the high-profile cases that are in a fishbowl. I have one of the fastest-growing units in the state attorney's office, and that's nothing to brag about. That
right.
sex crimes are on the rise, and people don't realize this because we see the once in a while, every 3 weeks, I'm on, you know, HLN or Fox or whatever, talking about the guy that got arrested. For everything, for all the, that one person that got arrested, I've got, you know, 17 other cases sitting in my office. So the people have to be aware that this truly is an epidemic and something needs to be done, and that's really education. And teachers shy away from it. They want to pass the buck to the parents. Parents shy away from it. They want the teachers to do it. So everybody's kind of got to get together and say, we need a plan. We need a program. We've got to let these kids know, starting when they first talk, that no one touches your private parts, and this is the name of your private parts, and it's nothing to be. It's the adults that are more embarrassed than the kids are. You teach a kid you know, that this is their penis, they're not going to start laughing. That's just like their elbow or their finger or their toe. That's just the name of their private part. So I'll just keep going and going until everybody feels comfortable discussing it.
Yeah, were you a fan of that show? That since they took the they took it off the air because I believe the DA blew his head off, To Catch a Predator with Chris Hansen.
The reason why, I mean, listen, it was very informative for people to see that actually goes on. Unfortunately,
right.
with the legal wranglings and the procedure and what's admissible in court and Miranda rights and custody and all that. You know, a lot of the cases had issues because Chris Hansen wasn't a police officer. He wasn't allowed to ask questions. Were they in custody? Were they not? So, well, I think it was informative for people to see
mm-hmm.
that this is not BS, that this really happened. I think in the long run, a lot of the cases didn't end up, you know, in a good way because of some of the actions that were taken.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you could have one nut just bring a gun. And he could have shot Hansen. They might have had a plan or something. But you're right. You know, it did make people aware. And, you know, some of those people that got caught, they're going to be on YouTube for the rest of their life. So that's worse than being in jail for a couple of years. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And go ahead.
No, yeah, something to add to that?
No, I was just going to say that, you know, with sex crime thing, you got to see that in that show. Everyone always asks me, like, what's the profile of a sex offender? And the fact of the matter is, you cannot profile. Everyone has this vision of the guy in a trench coat with glasses in a van at the end of the street. It could be the guy next door. It's not just the priest. I've prosecuted rabbis. I've prosecuted doctors and mortgage brokers.
Yeah.
Anybody. It's really could be anybody. And that's why I tell parents, you know, if someone has an unnatural relationship with your kid, it's an adult who doesn't want you to be around, who's extremely attached to your child. I'm not saying it's always going to be a pedophile, but I'm telling you that it's grounds to start asking some questions. Don't bury your head. If you have some concerns,
absolutely.
Then make sure you start questioning things.
Okay, I want to get your take on the George Zimmerman trial, but first let's play the verdict, then we'll come back and we'll review it.
Okay.
And I will remind everybody in the courtroom that there's to be no outbursts upon the reading of the verdict or afterwards. Please be seated. Members of the jury, have you reached a verdict? If you'll please hold the verdict form and hand it to Deputy Jarvis. Okay, if you'll please publish the verdict.
In the Circuit Court of the 18th Judicial Circuit in and for Seminole County, Florida, State of Florida versus George Zimmerman, verdict, we the jury find George Zimmerman not guilty. So say we all, four person.
Does either side want to poll the jury?
We would, Your Honor.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, as your juror number is being called, please answer whether this is your verdict.
Juror B.
Stacey Honowitz, when you heard that Saturday night, give me your thoughts.
Well, I have to tell you, I was very surprised. It kind of went both ways. I saw the difficulty in the case. As a prosecutor, I thought that it was going to be a very difficult case, as it is in stand your ground and self-defense cases when the other party is not there, who's deceased, to tell you what happened. So you have George Zimmerman giving six versions of what happened that night. So I know that based on the self-defense laws in the state of Florida, and we have stand your ground, which has made us the wild, wild west, what the prosecutors were trying to bring out, I don't think the prosecutors had a concrete theory on what happened. I mean, as a prosecutor, I was waiting for them, and I'm not saying that they tried a bad case. I'm not saying that I didn't think that he was, you know, guilty. But as a prosecutor, you have to be able to stand up there in your closing argument and say, we've proved to you beyond the exclusion of every reasonable doubt, here's what happened in this case. And you didn't hear that. You just didn't hear that. You heard a lot of sympathy, evoking sympathy, which the jury instruction tells you that sympathy is not a legally reasonable doubt. You know, you can't feel sorry for anybody in the court. It's all part of the instruction. But you can't be devoid of those emotions. You know, when we bring you in as jurors, we tell you to leave your prejudice and your bias outside the courtroom door, but we tell you to bring in your common sense, and we know that you wouldn't be a human being if you didn't feel emotion or you didn't feel sympathetic about what happened. So while both sides, I think, and for the jurors, the defense, of course, won out, I think it was tough. But I was thinking that a manslaughter charge would come back. I thought that the ill will, hatred and spite, that's a high burden for the state to have to prove. But I did think it was an intentional act which resulted in death. And I think that the points of him showing the inconsistencies, the prosecutor showed the inconsistencies in the story that it should have been stated, there's so many inconsistencies. He had a professor that said he knew all about self-defense. He got an A in the class, and that you have to disbelieve what he told you. Now, there's evidence, of course, that he was being punched. That's not controverted, that he certainly was being punched. But, you know, we always tell jurors, you know, different witnesses can see different things at different times from different angles. And people came out at different times, and like I said, there's a lot of maybes. And so when you have a lot of maybes and you stand in front of a jury and you're asking them to speculate, then you know that they're going to find reasonable doubt. And certainly in this case, the Florida law on self-defense, on justifiable use of deadly force, what he said was, I was, you know, there was serious bodily harm coming to me and the threat of death. Now, the argument on the flip side for the prosecutor is, how serious could it be? The cuts on the back of your head were 1 centimeter. You didn't seek medical attention. If you thought that you were, you know, there was serious bodily harm or death was going to come your way, you didn't think to go to the hospital afterwards, maybe there was a blood clot. I think the argument could have been that the story was made up just based on what we saw. But the jury really didn't have a choice. You have to respect the jury's decision. They felt as though George was cooperative, Zimmerman was cooperative. and they heard from the state's witness that became a defense witness, basically said they saw Trayvon Martin on top. And so while I might not agree with the verdict, as I'm sure a lot of people don't agree with this verdict, it's the jury that came back, and you have to respect what they did. You can sit here from now until next whatever trying to debate it, but the fact of the matter is the jury has spoken. They believed George Zimmerman, and they believed that self-defense law applied to him, and that's what he was doing. He had justifiable use of deadly force.
Do you think if they just charged a simple, maybe involuntary manslaughter, that they would have a better chance of getting it?
I think what's really important, I don't know, because I don't, listen, I've been doing this for such a long time, and people always tell me when I have a jury out, well, what do you think? I've been surprised so many times, and you can't read the tea leaves. Jurors are going to do what they want to do. And even I heard the prosecutor say they were nodding at me, and that's like a telltale sign. So many times they've nodded at me, and you kind of get the feeling
right.
They're with you, and then they come back, and it's not guilty. You're like, what are you talking about? You're all nodding at me. So I've learned to say, who knows what a jury's going to do, but I will tell you one thing. I heard the juror speak out on Anderson Cooper, and she talked about the jury instructions, and it was very enlightening, although I did know this from past cases. You know, these jurors, unlike criminal lawyers like myself and many of my colleagues, were in court every single day. I've tried well over 200 jury trials in my career. I hear the instructions all the time. We know the instructions. We hear them. We understand how to apply them. A jury is really sitting there as neophytes, as lay people, really just sitting in court, and they hear the judge read the instructions at the end of the case. That's like a cursory reading of the instructions. I think it's imperative for any lawyer on either side to stand up in their closing argument and explain the jury instructions, because the judge reads them quickly. You need time to absorb them, to take them in, and what the lawyer's job to do is to explain those instructions and take the facts and the theory of their case and apply them to the instructions. Here's the elements of the crime, here's what the state needs to prove to you, and here's what we have proved to you. Self-defense is A, B, C, and D. Justifiable use of deadly force occurs when there's A, B, C, and D. And she said that they felt the instructions were confusing, and I think that I don't know if it would have made a difference, but I think there needed to be some time on the state's closing where that law, including manslaughter, many times we stand up and we say, if you believe the state has improved the highest charge, which would be the murder too, if you believe that, but you believe all the other elements have been met, such as for manslaughter, then you can return a verdict for manslaughter. And jurors want to be able to know what they can do. Just like the defense stood up and said, if you find that self-defense, there was justifiable use of force, that applies not only to the murder too, that also applies to manslaughter. So I think there needs to be more. I thought in this case, and I don't know if it would have made a difference because, again, the theory on the state side was not brought out that well. I don't know if it would have made a difference. I just think it's something that jurors crave, because I've had many discussions with many jurors after a case, and I've learned that they've said, we needed somebody to go over the instructions with us. We just didn't quite get them when we went back there. So, you know, there's a lot of things in this case, like I said, that we can talk about. I wasn't surprised by the verdict. I didn't want the verdict to be that way because, you know, for whatever reason, it's a tragedy.
Right.
It's just a tragedy the way you look at it. But under the self-defense law, the way it was argued, and the threat, you know, it's very subjective. It's basically he felt it. He didn't have to suffer serious bodily harm. He just had to fear great bodily harm. And I think that there's got to be modifications to the law because it's just too broad and just too subjective.
Okay, I want to play your friend Judge Janine. Her opening statement, what she said, we'll come back on the other side and we'll talk about it. Here we go.
But tonight, in the wake of this verdict, many are asking, should charges have even been brought in this case in the first place? And did the police chief and the state's attorney, now no longer in those positions, initially make the correct call in not filing charges? Did the special prosecutor appointed by the governor file charges because of political pressure? I've said this before. The power is enormous. The process overwhelming. The consequences dire. It is a decision to engage and put into motion the criminal justice system. The decision to charge someone with a crime. The decision that puts everything about the accused at risk. His reputation, his livelihood, his family, and his civil liberties. The one who makes this decision, the one who carries the ultimate power, the district attorney, the chief prosecutor. And tonight, George Zimmerman is a free man, acquitted of the murder of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. But in the aftermath of this verdict, the nation grapples with the difficult issues played out in that small courtroom in Sanford, Florida. Self-defense, profiling, manslaughter, stand your ground. The ultimate question, though, should charges have even been filed in the first place? The duty of a prosecutor is not merely to convict, but to seek justice. The duty of a prosecutor is to be fair and objective to both sides. The duty of a prosecutor is to follow the law. The job is a weighty one. It is a difficult one. But it becomes even more problematic when public pressure becomes part of the equation. Problem every elected prosecutor encounters. I know. I've faced the public outrage of unpopular prosecutorial decisions. But any prosecutor worth his or her salt knows politics ends on election night. Politics have no place in the courthouse, and politics must be abandoned on the courthouse steps. The job is about the law and the facts, nothing more and nothing less. The obligation to bring charges and engage the system only where the prosecutor believes that the case can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to the unanimous satisfaction of the entire jury.
When we announced the charges 15 months ago, we also promised that we would seek the truth for Trayvon Martin and due process for George Zimmerman, that we would get all of the facts and details of this very difficult case before a jury, and that we chose to do it that way because we felt that everyone had a right to know everything about this case.
Almost every legal expert on both sides of the aisle agreed, though, in
Stacey Hunter, with some strong words from Judge Jeanine. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts?
Well, listen, I know Judge Jeanine. I've been on the air with her. I heard her talk about all this over the weekend, and there are lots of things that she said that I do agree with. A prosecutor's job is to seek justice. A prosecutor's job is not to just file charges haphazardly. What I don't agree with is the fact that she does not know the inner workings of what this prosecutor's office did know many times, and I don't know if they succumbed to political pressure. I can't talk about that because I don't know. And I don't think I know enough about how the process works up there to me to discuss. The only thing I can discuss is they believed that they had a good faith basis and that they could prove murder two beyond into the exclusion of every reasonable doubt that there was a reasonable likelihood of conviction. That is the role of a prosecutor. It's to seek justice, but to be able to take a step back and say, can we do it? It was their belief that they could. Now that the verdict is in, now that people have heard some of the evidence or a lot of the evidence, their feeling is that there should never have been a prosecution to begin with. That was not the feeling of the people in Jacksonville. They reviewed all the evidence. They believe he profiled Trayvon Martin. They believed he didn't have the right to use deadly force based on what they saw, and that so they had the right to go ahead and file this information based on what their evidence showed and what their belief was. I totally agree with her. I think a prosecutor has to use discretion. A prosecutor cannot haphazardly file charges because they feel like filing charges. They don't know what their decision was. I do know that sometimes cases are investigated by more than one office, by more than one police department. And in this case, like I said, I don't feel comfortable enough. I only heard what Angela Corey said, how she explained herself, and how she explained the actions of the office. There are times you have to make very unpopular decisions. I mean, I had to in no process, a case that got national attention. You know, it was all over the news. It was big. I looked at the evidence. The case was originally filed based on something else, and then when other evidence came in, when experts came in to analyze certain things, I had to take a good hard look. And it was difficult because I knew that I would get flack for it, you know, from the public. But I knew what the evidence had and what it said, and I wasn't going to cave to that, and I had to dismiss the charges. So while I'm only speaking for myself. I can't speak for how other offices run or how other attorneys decide how to handle a case.
There's some people in the legal field that feels that she should have went to at least the grand jury. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised that the grand jury didn't make the decision, but down here our grand juries really decide on capital murder one cases, and special cases involving special prosecutions when there's an officer shoot, you know, a cop shooting and things like that. She's the state attorney. She's the elected official. She has the final say. And they filed an information on murder two, which is what we do. We file information. We don't take murder two cases to the grand jury in Florida. At least in my office, we don't.
Do you remember the case back in 2006 with the lacrosse team and that prosecutor?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you remember what went wrong there? I mean, did he definitely overcharge? I don't know.
I'll tell you that what was very interesting in that case, I don't mean to cut you off, and it was Mike Nifon, and it was the Duke lacrosse case.
Right.
What I found extremely interesting about that case was he never spoke to the victim. When he was asked, what did the victim say, they never interviewed the victim. So it was even very frustrating from the beginning. You have a rape case, and you haven't spoken to the victim to find out what the story was. So, you know, I don't remember all the ins and outs, but I remember that was one thing that stuck with me. I'm not saying that people don't, I don't want to say screw up, but I'm not saying that some bad decisions aren't made. I think in this case they believed that they could prove the highest charge, which was murder two. She sat on the air and she said, we believe he was profiled. We believe that there was ill will. We believe based on the words that he used, there was no reason for him to get out of the car. There was no reason to walk over to him. He wasn't a cop, you know, and this was, you know, and basically, you know, people are saying, why didn't he just knock him off of him? Why did he have to take out his gun and shoot? He was on top of it. You know what I'm saying? So they believe
they had the evidence.
Why did
he get out of the van? Like, it's a $1 million question that was never explained.
Yeah. You know, that's the thing. Like, did you have to use, and that's what they're saying, that they did not believe, based on the evidence that they had, that justifiable use of deadly force was necessary. He's using,
I don't know if you saw his MySpace surface back in 2005, and it shows that he was, he did something bad to his then fiance. He was in police custody. I know that was not entered into evidence, but could something like that have been entered into evidence?
Well, it all depends. I mean, I remember Mark O'Meara talking about the fact that there was a restraining order. It was a mutual restraining order between him and either his then-girlfriend or his then-wife, and the restraining order was dismissed against him at one point, and there was a battery charge, an aggravated battery charge that got dropped to a battery charge. The Florida rules of evidence are very specific with regard to character evidence and prior bad act evidence. If the door had been open to his peaceful conduct, if someone took the stand and said he's a peaceful person, he's never been in trouble before, things like that that Mark O'Meara knew he could never open the door to, then that stuff might have been able to come in. You'd have to have a pretrial hearing to make the determination how relevant it was. And, his reputation for being peaceful and stuff like that. You know, sometimes in a self-defense case, they want the victim's, prior bad acts to come out. And that's what they were trying to do when they were trying to say that he had marijuana in his system.
Argue that, you know, that wouldn't really stir up a fight.
Right. And the thing is, the judge was going to allow them to do that, but I think they realized that something
like
that was not going to play well.
What did you think of this judge?
I liked her because we've been seeing all these high-profile cases where these judges have just kind of let the lawyers, it's turned into a three-ring circus. The case
Jody Arias.
We had Jody Arias, and even when we go back to O.J. and Judge Ito, and just letting them get away with stuff, and things got dragged out for 4 months. This judge ran a tight ship. She started on time.
Went quickly.
She didn't want to speak. Huh?
I said it went quickly.
Yeah, it went
quick. Jody.
Exactly. She didn't allow for speaking objections. She didn't, she didn't want people talking. And I thought that the lawyers handled themselves very well. I really do. I mean, she's no nonsense, which I thought was great. I mean, sometimes as a lawyer, it sounds good to be on the outside saying she's great. If I was in the courtroom trying the case, I might have said, she's making a stay till 10 o'clock, and but this is she knew it could get out of hand, and she didn't let it get out of hand because it was high profile. And I have to tell you that I think the lawyers on all sides were very respectful. I know that people were very upset with, the defense and the knock-knock joke, which I thought was, in such poor taste and despicable. And he got into it with the judge a couple times, and that happened. I mean, people don't realize when you're in trial, it's so stressful to begin with. Even if you're in trial and nobody's walking in the courtroom to watch you, but you have to imagine being in a fishbowl like that where the world is watching, pressure is intense, everyone's watching every move. And that's why I refuse to Monday morning quarterback how these lawyers did, because I wouldn't like it. I only made the opinion that I just thought that the law should have been stressed more in the closing argument. But as far as their skill level, they're top-of-the-line guys, and they certainly know the evidence much better than I do. So kudos to all of them.
Would you ever think of becoming a judge, or did you ever – think, or do you want to become a judge?
No, it's very interesting. So many of the people that I've practiced with for years, even some of that I've supervised, are now sitting on the bench, and people have asked me a number of times, why don't you toss your name in or whatever. I really have no desire to do that. I think that I would be bored. It's just not my personality. I think I'd much rather be in the courtroom arguing than refereeing, and I really enjoy where I am and what I do, supervising this unit, supervising the lawyers under me, and dealing with a lot of the high-profile cases in Broward County where I practice, and I just really have no desire to go on the bench.
Have you ever seen a defendant such as Castro? Is there anything worse than that?
Oh, yeah. He is really, the worst of the worst, but I can tell you that I have had some sex cases that would really make your hair stand up, that are really, there's many times where you get a thick skin and you've seen it all. I've seen it all so many times. I've heard everything. Nothing shocks me. But there are some cases that come across my desk that I just, would not believe. I mean, when you have the rape of a 3-year-old, I had a rape, somebody came across my desk, my colleague's desk, a 5-year-old girl that was just repeatedly raped and had to be in surgery, 5 different times because of the injuries that she suffered. I mean, it's horrific. When I got a case it was a father who was having, you hear the cases about the father or the biological relative having sexual relations with the kid. You can't envision it. You see it on paper. But then when you see photographs of it or video of it, it is just so hard to comprehend that even for somebody like me who, like I said, has seen it all, it's a night of it. It's not
there
sleeping
are actually
and
people
thinking
that
about
actually
it.
Get off. There's actually people that actually get off on videotaping it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that really does become like a thrill to have it documented. And I have to tell you something, sometimes, it's as disgusting and as despicable as it is, I'm grateful sometimes because that's how we've caught people. The wife has found the tape. The wife has found the cell phone with photographs on it.
Mm-hmm.
On the computer and seeing things. So while on the one hand it's so repulsive and so disgusting, on the other hand it's how we get our evidence and how we get our case. So it's a double-edged sword.
Okay, I want to play a clip. The guy who passed away from that show, Glee. We'll come back on the inside and we'll talk about it.
The only thing in the world she wanted to do was to come visit the cast of Glee. I mean, to put a smile on somebody's face in such a bad situation like that, is there anything more important than that?
Wow, that is the late Glee star, Corey Monteith, talking about making a dream come true for a terminally ill fan. Monteith, who died over the weekend in Vancouver, said that he was just happy to be able to use his star power to do some good. And tonight, a showbiz mystery, the sudden death of Corey Monteith, still has fans and his loved ones waiting for answers. Right now, the coroner is waiting for the results of some toxicology tests. But you know that could take days. It could take even weeks. Plus, another mystery on the horizon. New reports out today revealing that the new season of Glee may be delayed while producers try to figure out how in the world they're going to address Corey's death on the show. Meanwhile, tonight, we're getting a showbiz first look at Corey's final acting role in the indie film Mechanic. He plays a drug-addicted hustler. Look.
You ever think about getting a real job?
I got a job, and I make really good money when asking cops to fuck it up.
My mistake?
Yeah.
Yeah. We found your boy. Raven's name is Peter Kirtner. He's from Queens, New York.
Is he a bank?
I don't know.
Yeah, such a huge cry from Corey's role as Finn Hudson on Glee. I mean, the movie's plot has a lot of people asking if Corey's own past troubles with addiction might have caught up with him. To talk more about that, TV and radio host Michael Billy joining me now from New York. So, Michael, Corey, he just got out of rehab, we know, for the second time back in April, his first stint years ago. But by all accounts, I mean, he was doing great. He was on the right track. We don't know what caused his death yet. But what do you make of the fact that he played a drug addict for his last acting role?
Well, I mean, it's the reality for a lot of addicts out there, but I think Corey's death may shed light that addict behavior is not just what you just saw in that film. I mean, we come in all shapes and sizes, some very high-functioning. Myself, I've been to rehab about 5 times throughout my career, successful and not, and I think if we can learn from this, it's that addiction is something that lives with us. It's not something to be forgotten, and that, you know, rehabilitation is a very critical part of someone's life, especially when they're going through the rehab process.
Yeah, it's just heartbreaking. It's cool that you've been so public about your struggles in the past.
It's important. It's the only way to be.
And maybe if we talked about it more, it wouldn't be such a huge issue. More people could tackle it together. Now, Glee is also, it's up in the air right now, the future of it. I mean, he was dating co-star Lea Michele. He had a big role on the show. So you know the producers right now, they're trying to figure out how to handle his death on the show, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, now, I think Glee has been not shy about tackling some horrific issues of bullying, suicide, death. I mean, they've really, school shootings. So hopefully they'll be able to make this a teaching moment.
Yeah, you know what? I think you might be onto something. We'll see what happens, and we'll be watching for sure. Michael Billy, thank you so much for your insight on that.
Well, Stacey, only 31 years old, Corey. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, there's nothing to say. It's absolutely tragic. There was some information today that said some of the cast was making some efforts. They knew that he had a problem, was making some efforts to try to help him along. But there's nothing to say. I mean, honestly, it's horrible. I feel horrible for his family, horrible for his girlfriend. I mean, you know, it's what goes on, and people try to get help, and you just hope that when they go into rehab that they can maintain clean. I mean, he had everything. I mean, talent and looks. And there's really nothing to say other than it's just a terrible loss for the family and for people that loved him on the show. And I don't know. It's just, you know, we talk about drugs. We see it in the criminal justice system. We see how, they can kill. And here is a prime example of it. So, you know, there's not
it's
much.
It's amazing,
to
though, from you go back to the 80s or 70s, it wasn't like this. I mean, like on a regular monthly basis, you hear of an actor dying, whoever it is, that lovely star, Nicole, what's her name there, I'm drawing a blank, from 2007, the mother.
Oh, no. I don't remember who it was. And then you have the, you know, what came out yesterday was that, Lindsay Lohan, who's been in and out of
Lindsay Lohan.
and the court system and everything that she's been through, and now she's going to be out and making $2 million.
Anna Nicole Smith is the lady I was thinking about.
Anna Nicole Smith, and that was in Broward County. That's right where I practiced. I mean, that was right in the Hard Rock Casino, you know, 5 minutes from my office. But, you know, sometimes it's glamorized. Drugs use is sometimes glamorized, and you know, what can you say? There's nothing that I can add, unfortunately, other than I hope his family is doing okay. I really do.
No question. But, you know, like in Florida, Florida, the word is that all these prescribed pills is what's killing everybody.
Pill mills.
Yeah, I mean,
we're cracking down on them. We're trying to really crack down on them. Our Attorney General down here is making a valiant effort, and they are.
But
they're,
the problem is also, Stacey, maybe you agree with me, is that the doctors are becoming, you know, part of the criminals, you know? They're going along with it.
We've had several arrests of doctors that are writing these prescriptions. And, you know, it's set by example. But then these doctors are getting arrested or spending time in jail. You know, that's, you know, you hope that that's a deterrent for others.
Right.
So we'll have to see. But like I said, down here, the pill mill situation, we're trying to hopefully put, you know, an end to it. But there is one thing I want to say, if you don't mind, I'm going to go back to Zimmerman.
Go right ahead.
The only reason I want to go back is because I have a comment that came through that I want to make sure that everybody is aware. I know I talked about the injuries, and I know that Angela Cord talked about the injuries, and that the injuries don't have to be sufficient in order to claim self-defense. That's true. It's the fear of serious bodily harm that's going to come to you, or the fear of death. And while what I was trying to say was the argument on the side of the prosecutors was his story actually truthful, in that he was being bashed down 25 times because the injuries did not compare to what he said had happened. But again, the self-defense law gets, it's the subjective, it's the fear of it. So Gina, who wrote me and wrote me that comment, you're 100% right. If I didn't say it correctly, it's the fear. But what the prosecutors were trying to bring out was his story was not reasonable. His story was kind of made up based on what you saw the injuries were compared to what he said had happened. So that's how I'm clearing that up. So thank you for writing in.
Absolutely. They're listening. Okay, I want to talk about Andrea Snyderman, but let's take a listen to this.
Somebody's been shot and killed out for a Dunwoody prep.
The motive is simple. He wanted his wife, he wanted his money, and he wanted to live his life. He wanted Andrea Snyderman. He wanted to be with her. He wanted to marry her. He wanted Rusty Snyderman's money. Rusty Snyderman had everything that Hemi Newman wanted.
Did Andrea admit or deny an affair with her boss at that time after the murder? Based on all the time you've known Andrea, based on your observations of her, her mannerisms, when she told you no, did you believe her?
No, but my heart really wanted to believe her.
But you didn't believe her. Thank you.
So,
defendant as to count one, guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, but mentally ill.
It's more than about mental illness. It is about mental illness in the hands of a manipulator, of a calculating, very, very bad woman.
Do you have any idea why the defendant would have these feelings toward you? And I want you to speculate. Do you know why he might have them?
I think I'm a pretty nice person.
she actually thought she could take the witness stand and maintain the position that she's maintained since Rusty's death, which is that there was no relationship with Hemi.
The gun, in this case, was in Hemi's hand. But the trigger, I respectfully suggest, was pulled by Andrea Snyderman.
Ms. Snyderman was placed under arrest earlier today and is currently being booked into the DeKalb County Jail. Outlined in that 19-page indictment are 8 counts that I, along with Chief Assistant Don Geary, are prepared to argue in a court of law.
Andrea Snyderman is pleading to nothing. We expect that she will be exonerated at trial. She has every reason to believe she will be exonerated at trial, and she is going to come to court.
Stacey Hanowitz, the Andrea Snyderman case set to take place jury selection July 29th. What's your thoughts on this upcoming case?
This is going to be a doozy, and I got to tell you something. This is going to be a case that everybody is going to be fascinated about because it involves a husband, alleged sexual contact with other people, that she was involved, and everybody likes the story like this. I mean, this is like a made-for-TV movie. I don't know if people remember when she took the stand, how she adamantly denied that she had any kind of relationship with him, that she didn't really know him. She really played this role of deer in a headlights. And then later on, we came to find out that they checked into a hotel together, and they were dancing together, and they were together. And so, like I said, I don't know all the evidence that's going to come out, but certainly she lied on the stand. That's why they charged her with perjury. She lied about the relationship. She lied about how long she knew him. And so I think we're in for – she's not going to plead, so you don't have to worry. There's going to be a trial. I'm hoping that it starts on the 29th. I guess they've got all their ducks in a row, so we'll have to wait and see. But this will be – headline news will be all over this, just like they have been for all the other cases, and you'll see everybody on the air putting in their 2 cents, including me.
Yeah. You know what the counts that she's being charged for? Well, we know
she's
perjury.
She's being charged
that's
with,
one.
Like, 3 counts of perjury – conspiracy to commit murder, attempted murder, principal in a murder. There's a bunch of charges against her.
So,
they're saying that she
masterminded
it. The bottom line is they're saying that she's the mastermind. She motivated this guy who's bipolar and delusional, this boss of hers. She's the one that told him
about
her.
You believe that story?
Yeah.
That he, you do?
Yeah, I do. I think that the idea that she lied about any kind of relationship that they had, where people saw them together and kissing and doing whatever, and then she was involved with another guy, and so she put this guy up to it. Listen, I'm not going to say, look, I'm a prosecutor, so everyone's expecting me to say she's guilty, she's guilty. I don't know if she's guilty. I'm waiting to see what the evidence is. So, but for now, I thought that on the stand, I didn't think she was credible just from her actions, just the way she answered the questions. And, you know, there was always down the line, people were saying, why haven't prosecutors charged her? Because they had some evidence that she was involved. So we're just going to have to wait and see. Everybody tune in.
Yes. And let's plug your stuff. Your website is www.stacyhanowitz.com. Also, your 2 books before we let you
books
go.
Are
your 2 books?
Genius of the Penis Don't Touch, and My Privates Are Private. And I'm walking around my house now freaking out because I just realized that my dog has eaten all the chocolate out of my pocketbook. So I'm glad that I'm going to have a big night with my dog.
How is it over there in Florida? Is it hot? Because I'm in New York, and it feels like I'm in Florida times 10.
Well, I know you guys are baking, and it's been hot down here.
Yeah.
But the last couple of days, it's been raining really, really bad, and so it's cool. It's not horribly hot because we've gotten the rain down here for the last couple of days. But there's almost
thanks for coming on.
We're hot all the time. Well, thanks for having me. It was my pleasure. I hope your listeners thought it was a good interview. And don't forget, if anybody has any questions, go to my website, and I'll be more than happy to answer them.
Okay, Stacey, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks a million.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we will be back Monday with sports and WWE and possibly Friday again with Charles Thompson. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye. Actually, let me play the Howard Stern clip, if I could find it. Let me play the Howard Stern. Howard Stern, do I have it? Do I have it? I will play the juror. Okay. Let's play this.
Bowie. Ah, yeah. One of my favorites. All right, Larry King is here. Larry now has a show on Hulu and Aura.tv. I'll ask him about that. I'm not sure I even understand Aura.tv. Larry King was the host of Larry King Live for like 25 years or something crazy like that.
And he
like
was on radio for even longer, right?
Larry King. Wow. Hi, Larry.
Never saw him out of a studio before.
I know. Hey, Larry, I said to Robin, Robert, how long did you host Larry King Live for? 25 years?
26. It turned out to be... supposed to be 25, but then when we parted ways, they told me to stay an extra year, so I stayed 26.
26-year run.
The longest, what is it? I got the Guinness thing. It's the longest running show hosted by one person at the same time on the same network.
Did you, you started out, they were paying you $200,000 a year. By the time you finished, you signed a $35 million contract for...
4 years.
4 years. Did you ever think that it was going to, like, work into that? Because when CNN started, and you first started there, it wasn't that much happening.
The story is, I started on their fifth anniversary. They went on June 1st, 1980, and I joined them June 1st, 1985. And I was doing my radio gig, like you were in Washington.
Yeah.
And I had a real nice gig. I was doing my... all-night radio show was all over the country. I had the first national network radio show, and I was very happy. I had a local television show on Channel 7.
Did you do both at first? I always did both.
I always did both? Yeah, always did both. And then Ted Turner calls me up. And I love working. Nobody liked Ted. And he calls me up like on a Tuesday, and he says, Sandy Freeman's doing a show here from 9 to 10 at night. I'm...